I feel sad for people who are not accessing their own creativity and who are ignoring it, or people who say, oh, I can't draw. I think that's sad, because anyone who has a hand and fingers and a pen or a pencil can draw. No one cannot draw. Anyone can draw. But if that attitude is so heartbreaking, because I can't draw means you think you can't draw something that looks like what you think it's supposed to be. You know, people say, I can't draw me. They mean they can't make a dog look like a dog. But why does a dog have to look like a dog? And that attitude, the attitude like a dog does not have to look like a dog, that attitude is a really good attitude for life, I think. Like you can draw a dog and it can be whatever it wants to be. It doesn't have to look like a dog. And that's kind of my philosophy of life, that that kind of individuality is good. It's fine. You don't have to fit into a category. You don't have to fit into a group. You can be an outsider, and that's okay, because whatever is true is okay.
Hello, and welcome to episode 41 of Attention Engineer. I'm Laura, and this is my podcast. Hi. Attention Engineer is a series where I seek to make the best use of my own valuable time and attention by having deep conversations with fellow artists about creativity, grit, and determination. My aim is to consistently remind you and remind myself that creativity really is for everyone, because it really is. Let's kick that inner critic where it hurts and have a thought-provoking time in the process. You don't have to make something of your own after listening to this show. There's no homework. But please know that you can if you want to. Hello, and welcome to Attention Engineer. How are you? I'm very well, thanks for asking. It's actually my first day back in the launch pad after an isolation holiday on a farm near Chepstow, just 30 minutes drive from my house in Bristol. The weather was gorgeous. We had blazing sun almost every day, and we took very long walks in three different beautiful forests, plus managed to squeeze in a movie marathon of gritty 90s thrillers. Perfection. Tim and I really did need a break. I celebrated my 40th birthday last week with a number 24 spot in the official UK albums chart. So if you bought my new album Exotic Monsters, a massive thanks to you for that wonderful present. It's been incredible reading messages from people telling me that my new songs are soundtracking their days. That is so cool to hear. This is my fifth big album release, and even more than ever, I feel like I've handed the music over to you now. I took an intentional break from this podcast to concentrate on the album release, and I am back now, but in the interest of continuing to pursue a life of mindful productivity and digital minimalism, I will be publishing episodes every fortnight from now on. I've been thinking a lot about capacity and bandwidth recently, because burnout has been popping up regularly in my life for maybe the past year now. Plus, I was finding that doing an episode every week meant I couldn't make the most of the fantastic guests who have come on the show, because it always felt like it was already time for the next episode. The aim of this podcast is to go deeper, not to speed through everything, so I'm looking forward to a slightly more relaxed pace. Today, I'm very keen to share a conversation with one of my all-time favourite songwriters, Juliana Hatfield. This chat really was a dream come true for me. Juliana Hatfield is a musician and songwriter who has been releasing excellent albums since 1987, first with the Blake Babies, then the Lemonheads, solo, and more. I first heard Juliana's work in the Juliana Hatfield 3, whose 1993 album Become What You Are spawned two hit singles, My Sister and Spin the Bottle, which was used in the film Reality Bites. Alongside her 17 original solo albums, Juliana's extensive back catalogue also includes work under the name Juliana's Pony, collaborations with Matthew Kors of Nada Surf under the name Minor Alps, and Paul Westerberg of The Replacements under the name The I Don't Cares. She's also worked with Amy Mann, Susanna Hoffs, Tanya Donnelly, Exene Cervenka and John Doe. Plus, she even had a part in a Christmas episode of My So-Called Life. Juliana's work has been part of my record collection for as long as I can remember, always encouraging and inspiring me to share my innermost thoughts and record my own music. In 2018, I was beyond delighted to be invited to support the Juliana Hatfield 3 in London and Bristol, and it was a huge treat to get to speak to Juliana for this episode. Massive, massive thanks to Tanya Donnelly and Dean Fisher for helping to make this happen. You're the absolute best. In this conversation, we discuss writing about the truth, rejecting society's expectations and demonstrating alternative ways of living, finding creative freedom in limitations, sensitivity as a superpower, and home recording, Juliana's rocky transition from analog to digital recording, and how her new album Blood is her most misanthropic yet. Without further ado, here we go. This is a podcast about creativity and stuff, so we can really talk about anything. And it's just such a delight to have you on it. I really appreciate you saying yes, because you're one of my favorites. So,
well, yeah, thank you for asking me.
Yeah, of course. Well, would you mind introducing yourself for the listeners, please?
This is Juliana Hatfield, speaking from Cambridge, Massachusetts in the United States.
Excellent. How has life been going for you in the past year and a bit?
It has been interesting. I'll say more than that. Let's see, what else can I say? I feel like I have dealt with the isolation maybe better than some other people, because I'm used to some isolation. I've always pretty much lived alone, and because I prefer that, and I write alone, and I record a lot alone. So I really do enjoy being alone, and I actually thrive when I'm alone. So in that sense, I've been fine over the past year and a half. And fortunately, I've been physically in good shape, and I started running outdoors, which has been really great. That's a whole new thing for me. And I used to do it when I was younger. I used to run a lot when I was in college, and then I kind of stopped, and now I'm doing it again. And I ran all winter through all the weather, and that's been good for me.
Yeah. I took up running again after a break, like beginning of last year, so January. Mm-hmm. So I had all these ideas for like the new decade is going to be all of these new different things I'm going to do. And I'd had an accident. I broke my foot a few years beforehand, and I couldn't run for ages. Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah.
That's been a massive, massive like mental health saver for me. It's really good to hear you've got into it as well.
Yeah. And in the beginning, you know, when the whole locking down started, everything was so scary. You know, every time I coughed, or every time I had a sniffle, it was so scary. You know, you thought like, am I sick? And then when I started running, and for a while, you know, it takes you a while to build up your endurance. And it took me some time to get into the rhythm of the breathing, the even breathing. And I would think like, oh, my lungs are messed up. What's wrong with me? But then once I feel my lungs getting stronger. And now I just get right into the rhythm of breathing right away. And I know that there's no promises or no reassurances really in terms of health. Anything could happen any day, but it just somehow makes me feel good that I'm exercising my lungs and my heart. And it just makes me feel a little bit better. Yes. Mental health, definitely. It's good for that.
Yeah. For me as well, I think a lot of it's been about like, what things can I control? What's actually within my control? And things like going for a run are within my control, and things like writing a song are within my control to some extent, and that kind of stuff. So yeah, I definitely hear that.
Yeah, it's good. And it's part of it's soothing. I think things that are repetitive actions, like running every couple of days, a certain path, and then just rituals, they're soothing, and they help give my life a kind of rhythm that calms me down and helps me to do everything else that I want to do. Like, I'll run at a certain point, and then I'll read at a certain point, and then I'll be working on writing at a certain point and having these structures to my days and nights really helps me to be able to just live more reasonably and productively.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would imagine, I mean, to me, you seem like the most prolific artist ever because you're always putting out such, I'm going to gush a little bit, such brilliant albums, right? And so regularly as well.
Thanks.
It's really impressive. Someone I've looked up to for years. It's really interesting to hear you say that about routines and structures, because I think that stuff does really help with being. And when I say productive, I don't mean it in a kind of wringing every last bit of juice out of yourself, but like spending your time in a focused way on the things that you need to and want to, like writing music and stuff. Do you think that you get more done that you want to because of those structures and stuff?
Well, I always feel like I'm lazy and I'm very self-critical and I'm never contented really. So I always feel, because when I say I have these rhythms to my days, that might mean I'll work on writing for an hour or even less. And so in a day, you know, like when I was making my new album and I started making it at home, and some days I would work for an hour and then I would be burned out. It'd be a lot of that is because it's just like having to engineer myself, that the technical stuff really just like depletes my energy and it makes my brain explode. So anyway, working on writing or recording for an hour in a day sometimes, and I feel like that is not a lot, but it's something, and it, at least I know that I've done something productive. And then there are other things that I do that contribute to my work. So, you know, there's reading and there's thinking and there's absorbing or consuming other kinds of artwork and information. So I think that if you're an artist, everything around you is contributing to your work, I think.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. Corinne Tucker was talking to me on this podcast about how she thinks like writing for 4 hours a day is pretty decent.
Oh yeah.
That is a lot. I think that's a lot.
Yeah.
Because it is a really, really cognitively demanding thing. And like you say, when you're also doing the engineering, which I also do for myself, it's a lot more different parts of your brain having to work. It's really, it is taxing.
It is for me, especially as someone who, I have this issue with multitasking. I'm terrible at multitasking, and that includes my brain. I can't, my brain has to focus on one thing at a time, or I just like my head explodes. So for example, when I'm listening to music, or when I'm in the studio and listening back to my music, I tend to instinctively cover my eyes with my hands. I seem to hear better when my eyes are closed, and where I'm, that's just this all sight is blocked out. Mm-hmm. So for me, it really helps to focus on one sense at a time if I can. Mm. And I don't know why I was even saying that. How does that relate to what you're saying about
it? It relates to everything. I think I'm just nodding along when I'm quiet because I'm agreeing.
Yeah, right. I get easily overwhelmed by sensations, by things in my environment that come in to my bubble. If I'm concentrating on something and working, I'm so easily distracted by outside noises or noises in my building or by smells in my building. Like lately, I've noticed that the person who lives below me has been cooking a lot of meat, and I've been a vegetarian for decades, and I'm pretty laissez-faire. Like I don't try to get other people to become vegetarian, but she's been cooking this really nasty smelling, I think it's might be lamb or something. It's just like a really gross smell for me. It makes me want to leave the building. So that's a distraction for me. Smell. So I don't know, make of that whatever you want, but I'm, you know.
Yeah. I freak out, right? If there's too many noises going on at once, I can't handle it. And I kind of get angry. And so like I've been in this house, which is a plenty spacious enough house. I feel very lucky and all that. For the past year and a half with my lovely husband, Tim, who you've met, because when I played with you, he was there. Mm-hmm. And he didn't used to work from home. And it's been challenging, even though we have this wonderful relationship. And he's learned about me that if there's music playing and something else going on and then something else, I will just lose my fucking mind. Like I just can't cope anymore. So it's so, I mean, I'm sorry that that affects you too, but I'm so glad it's not just me, because I felt like I was just unable to deal with life.
Oh yeah. I really understand what you're saying and what you're feeling. I had the same experience. It's just really I have an emotional and physical reaction to that kind of thing, like too much competing information, you know. Yeah. It's just like it really depletes me and overwhelms me, and I don't know what. Maybe that has something to do with our artistic brains or our musical brains or something. I don't know. We need to regiment everything, all the sounds, we must be sensitive if we're artists. Mm. And I think that sensitivity is pertains to all parts of life, really, all the senses and all the feelings and thoughts and information.
Yeah. And I grew up being told that being sensitive was not great. Like in all different ways I was told that. So not necessarily in words, but sometimes in words, but in just people's actions. And I grew up thinking there was something wrong with me because I was sensitive to things. But then I was listening to Shirley Manson talking on a podcast the other day with Skin from Skunk and Nancy. And she was talking about how she thinks that being hypersensitive, as she called it, is actually a superpower. And that made me feel so much better.
It is. I mean, I do feel it's a superpower, although it can be, it's a power, but it can diminish other abilities, I think. Mm. The superpower of extreme sensitivity can disable your social skills, I think. You know, like if there's too much going on at a party, if it's too crowded or the music's too loud, I'll just, you know, I won't go. I will turn around and leave. Although I don't really go to parties anymore because I can't handle them.
I was going to say I wouldn't even be at that party. So good for you.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't either. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that I would even ever go to a party. But I feel like society, culture, Western culture, maybe all cultures, they seem to push everyone in a certain direction, and they make you feel like there's something wrong with you if you're not on a track to, you know, always be partnering up with someone, having a significant other. And if you're not sociable, and if you're not like working toward buying a house and having children, and if you don't want to go to parties, you're made to feel there's something wrong with you. Mm. Maybe people are just afraid of the hypersensitive people because they know that the hypersensitive people are reading their minds.
Yes.
We feel other people's pain. And we know what people are feeling without being able to necessarily always articulate it or even understand it. But I think that scares people. People who don't want to confront their feelings, or they don't want to confront their dark sides, they're afraid of people like us who have hypersensitivity powers.
Yeah. Be afraid. Be very afraid. I'm really excited about your new record as well. I've been reading that you recorded that in your apartment, or partly in your apartment. Is that right?
Yes. That was another thing that I took on when lockdown started. I finally confronted GarageBand on my laptop, something that I'd always wanted to figure out how to use, but never did, just because I hate computers and I'm afraid of the frustrations that come with technology hitting the wall. So I tackled that. And with the help of my friend Jed Davis in Connecticut, I was able to figure out how to make GarageBand work for me. And Jed was really he was like my troubleshooting partner, or he helped me so much. When I encountered a problem, I would run screaming to him, and he would talk me through. He was very calm and talked me through everything. So I did a lot of the album at home, and Jed took some things and programmed some drums and added some things to some songs. And then when a big chunk of it was together, I brought it over to Q Division Studios, brought it over, which sounds like I put it in the trunk of my car. I put the tapes in my car, but no, I sent the files over to Q Division, and then I finished the stuff up at the real studio and added some drum kit and some different kinds of loud amplifier, guitar sounds and stuff like that.
That's interesting, because I remember when Peace and Love came out, was it like around 2010? And I read that you'd recorded that at home. And
yes,
that really inspired me to start recording more at home. Were you recording at home with someone helping then for Peace and Love?
No, I was. The difference then was that I was recording onto a freestanding 8-track recorder, an eight-track digital machine that had faders, you know, that I could work with my hands, and it had built-in CD burner, and that was how I would mix these songs to a CD, and it would, and then I would, you know, I could master from the CD.
Oh wow.
So that, and then that was a great machine, and I loved it so much, and I made a couple of whole albums on it. I made the Wild Animals album also on that machine, and then the machine just died at some point. It just wouldn't work anymore, and then so for a while I was without anything to record onto. And then I thought about going to find that exact same machine on eBay and just replacing it, but then I didn't. And then I forced myself to just do GarageBand.
Yeah. How do you find it now that you've done a whole record on it?
I hate it. I hate it so much. No, I mean, it's fine. It's fine. It helped me. Mm. It's helpful to be able to record this way, but I never can really get used to it. It's just like, I don't trust the machinery. Just the fact that, you know, I can't put my hands on it. Mm. When I first opened GarageBand, I was like, all ready. I was gung-ho. I was like, okay, let's do this. I got my microphone cable ready to plug in. And then I realized, like, where do I plug in my microphone? There's no input. There's no hole big enough to stick it into. That's how ignorant I was. And then Jed told me I had to get an interface.
Yes.
And I was like, oh my God, really? Like, there's all this new stuff that I had to buy. And I just... It might not sound like anything to anyone else, but to me, it was like climbing mountains to even understand what an interface was, and then to have to, shop for one. Mm-hmm. Before that, I would just plug the microphone into the machine.
Yeah.
And then each input had its own fader, which I could see and move with my fingers. But now I have to use a cursor to make any movement. And it's just like, you have to learn that whole other, that whole world of touch and everything.
Yeah. Well, I totally understand. And I don't think it's at all weird that you had that experience. And hopefully some people listening will just feel better that they don't automatically know how to do complicated things.
Yeah.
Because you only know when you know, like, it's only obvious when you've learned it. And I live with a man who's learning at the moment how to record his own music. And he is going through a lot of emotional mountains.
Oh yeah.
Really hard. So, and I've been through it myself. I had a Jed when I first started recording myself. My friend Mike was the person on the end of the line, and I'd call him and go, "Why isn't this working?" When I was trying to use Cubase in like 2006 or something.
Uh-huh.
So now, like, I'm fairly okay with it all, but I still remember that. It's terrifying, and there's always something new to learn anyway.
Oh, it's like, that's what I was telling Jed. It's like, I would encounter some new problem, and it's like a labyrinth, really. I mean, the internet in general, but even GarageBand, there's just like infinite tracks. It's infinity, and it's terrifying and overwhelming so much because of that. It's a labyrinth that you never will be able to make your way through the labyrinth, because it's never ending. And that, for me, that's awful. That's an awful thing. Mm-hmm. And some people find that exciting and freeing, but I like to have boundaries in mm-hmm. every way and in every area of my life. And there, with this stuff, there are no boundaries, and I don't like that. And I'm surprised at how many people take to this stuff so quickly and easily, or seem to.
I think they just seem to, honestly.
And everyone's like, oh yeah, the latest thing, I got that done. And for me, it's like every time the world or the culture or the capitalism tells me that I have to upgrade my technology, I resist and I push against it, and I push and push. And I'm like, and everyone else seems to be like floating along. Sure, no problem. I'll learn this next version of this newest, latest technology, and then I'll get the next thing. No problem. And why is there not more resistance? And also, why is everyone able to figure everything out and I'm not?
I really don't think that's true, though.
I know. So then why aren't more people talking about it? How about these issues?
Maybe it's because they can't turn their computer on to have a chat about it.
Maybe.
They're all on like CB radios having a complaint about GarageBand, I think.
Yeah.
No, I think there are probably a lot of people who, because you could do anything now, and even just talking about GarageBand and Logic and all those things, you can have infinite tracks, infinite instruments, infinite ideas. Your songs can be as long as you want. But I think that will paralyze a lot of people into not doing anything. And that is bad. Yeah. Those constraints really, well, the constraints of a pop song, the constraints of any kind of, not commercial, but any kind of song, mean that you can only do so many things. Which means that you can have this like infinite creativity within 3.5 minutes, 4 minutes. But if someone could do anything, then it's terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've always thought that the more choices I have, the more problems I have, you know, like the more decisions, that's just more decisions to be made, which is just complicating my life. And I've always worked really well within with tight limitations. I find freedom in limitation. Like maybe it's budgetary limitation or it's number of tracks limitation. I do really well with without having a lot of choices. And yeah. I know when I used to have to, I would have a certain amount of days in which I had to record an album, or I had a certain number of tracks, and you learn to be, you're forced to be really creative and in those situations. And also you're forced to accept certain performances, certain flawed performances. You have to accept their imperfections, and those imperfections can actually become beautiful to you, or maybe they're beautiful immediately. But you know, if you have just infinite possibilities to tweak and polish something, it'll just polish it into blandness. You can the danger is you're gonna do so many takes that you lose the initial spark, or you over polish something to the point of dullness.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I wanted to ask you about how you have put music out under lots of different names. So would you say that those are kind of limitations that you set on yourself, or were they ways of thinking about a particular collection of songs to come out in a certain way?
I think it's maybe ways of thinking about, or I'm just trying to give a certain project a certain feeling, maybe. Like Juliana's Pony was like a very much like an indulgence, I think.
That's one of my absolute favorites.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, really.
And I gave it a name because it was a unique lineup. It was me, Mikey Welsh, and Zeph and Courtney, who were never together on any other recordings. And it just seemed to call for a certain separation from my other things. And then there's the fact that I just have so many songs and they need places to go. They need slots to go into, or otherwise it's just like a million Juliana Hatfield songs. And who's really going to pay attention to that?
I think a lot of people would, but I think it's better that you're someone who doesn't assume they would, because your music's probably better, if you know like what I mean.
Right. Well, one worries about oversaturation, but then then I have to realize, like, I'm such a small fish in the pond of popular music that there's no possibility of my oversaturating anything ever.
Yeah.
Oversaturating any area, because the area that I'm in is small enough that it's small enough that I can oversaturate easily. I don't know what I'm saying. I'll never oversaturate the large market.
Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah. So talking about millions of songs, because I do think you've already released millions of songs. Do you have loads that sit around that you then have to find the slot for?
No, not really. I usually, when I'm making an album, I usually have just enough songs to fill an album, or maybe one or two extras. So when I'm writing, I'm usually working toward an album's worth of songs. Mm. But what I do have billions of are little snippets of sound, little tons and tons of tapes and videos and recordings of pieces of music, or pieces of melody or chord progressions or riffs, tons of that stuff that I can go back and listen to and try to patch together later.
Do you find yourself going back to that very often?
I do. Every time I start writing after a period of not writing, I'll first go and start to look at little snippets of music and seeing if there's anything that I can work with.
Mm.
And some of that stuff will get me, it'll just get me like started on writing again.
Yeah. Because I ask everyone this when they mention their ideas library, because I have one that every now and again, I just think I should delete it. And then I think even its existence means I'm never having to start from the blank page. So I never have to be frightened. There's always something.
Oh, yeah. And you don't know if there's, if you could find gold in there later, you know, like, because I know for me, I don't always appreciate my ideas in the moment. And I'll toss things and think this is crappy, but then if I go back and listen years later, I'll think it's brilliant. And that actually happened when I was doing these fan funded albums on Pledge Music. Mm-hmm. One of the things I offered for sale was I sold some of my old cassettes full of, what did you call them? You had a really nice name for them. Ideas libraries.
Yeah, ideas.
That's library. A nice name. So I sold a few of my idea library cassettes full of musical ideas, full, like 45 or 90 minutes full.
Oh, wow.
And I sold one to a guy that I know he's in Cornwall, actually.
Mm.
And I took a listen to it. You know, I listened fairly carefully to these before I sold them. And I thought like, yeah, this stuff's not so great. I'll get rid of these and I'll won't worry about it. And then my friend in Cornwall, after a little while, he sent the cassette back to me. He just thought that I don't know why exactly. I think he thought I might want it back.
Mm.
And I listened to it again. And I heard this keyboard chord progression that I didn't remember ever having created or recorded, but and suddenly it jumped out and I thought it was great, and that became a song called what's it called, it's from the weird my weird album. It became the basis of the song It's So Weird.
Mm-hmm. Oh wow.
And if he hadn't sent it back to me, I probably never would have written that song.
Yeah. I love that. That's great. Yeah. So like previous Juliana had an idea that modern day Juliana could use. That's cool.
Yeah.
It's like a message from the past.
Yeah.
That's nice.
And the future.
Yeah. Do you find that you are someone who crafts songs? Because I talk to a lot of songwriters, of course, for this, and I think about it a lot myself, and there seems to be two different things people talk about. They talk about crafting a song, and then they talk about kind of channeling a song that comes in more of a fully formed way, so that the person doesn't think that they wrote it themselves. It's kind of coming from energy or mystical places.
Mm-hmm.
But you sound like someone who writes with quite a lot of intention. So I was just wondering how that works for you.
Well, It feels like a combination of both things to me. Mm-hmm. Writing a song is like a collaboration between me and the muses, or me and the universe, or the gods, or whatever, however you want to characterize whatever it is that brings the music to me. Because it does feel like I'm being given this music. But it's not enough for me just to sit there eating bonbons and accepting it. I have to do, like I said, it's a collaboration. So I have to get in the dirt. I'm using a lot of like metaphors here.
That's good.
And I have to start really like hauling. I start digging in the dirt. The crafting part is a big part of it. And you have to put in the work. It's like mining, really. It is. Mm. It's like once I've put in a lot of work on a song, and it can be, sometimes a song will be written in a few days. Sometimes it takes months and months of me just chipping away at it. Mm. And some of them don't even make it. Some of them, after months of work, I have to say, like, this is not working. This is not going to work. Mm. And I'll throw it away. But some are easier than others. Some are like very difficult labors, another metaphor, very, very long, difficult labors. Mm. Some end in death, but you know, and the songs don't ever come to completion. But some of them are like my birth, my actual birth. This is not a metaphor. I was a precipitous birth, which meant that I was early and fast. Like one night my mother felt like, oh wow, something's happening. And she called to my father. And before my father got upstairs, I was already all coming out.
Wow.
And so I basically, and this is, I'm going to put in another bit of information about that. Evan, my friend Evan Dando, wrote a song called It's About Time, and which had to do, he was trying to write from my perspective, and he wrote some, it's, the line is, fell out on the street, and that was a reference to my birth. Mm. My precipitous birth came coming out of my mother quickly and easily. So some songs are like that. They feel like they wanted to be born and they just can't, they come out quickly. And the song It's So Weird was like that. The song I was just talking about, that happened really quickly and it felt kind of like a dream. And it was a song that was not written before I went to the studio. And I had recorded most of the album already, the album Weird. And then this song was tagged on at the end. It wanted to be written. So it happened really quickly. And that one was one that really felt like it was just kind of given to me. And it already felt kind of like it already existed. So that was a really long answer.
That's good. That was a really interesting answer. Yeah. Well, thanks for telling me that. I find that so interesting. I've got a song called Cancel Your Hopes, which is obviously a very cheerful song, which I basically wrote it in 2005 and recorded it on a mini disc and then lost all my mini discs and then found them all again and then finished it off like really fast. So it felt like, yeah, like past Laura was going, here, have this gift.
Yeah.
And I went, thanks. And then I made it into this song. It was going to be the first single from the new project, but it seemed like it was far too depressing during a pandemic to say cancel your hopes to people as the first thing. I waited. But it's fine now. It's fine to be weird again now, surely by now.
I hope so.
Yeah, because your record surely isn't all like happy, clappy, everything's going to be okay, is it? What's the general theme?
I think it might be my most misanthropic album ever.
Awesome. I'm excited then.
Yeah. I mean, it's fun. It's fun, but it's not up with people. It's kind of down with people. Mm. Do you know what up with people is? Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I can't even explain it. I'm going to have to Google it because I can't remember. It's something from my childhood. It was like some campaign that went on the road to try to celebrate something. I don't know. It might have been like a, but when I say up with people, it's like, it means, you know, very positive confidence rock.
Yes.
Which this is not, it's the opposite of that. My new album.
Okay.
But it's just a reflection of the past 4 years in general, and the past year in particular, how it has been kind of a challenge for people. In my country, I was thinking of the past 4 years, you know, but it's been a challenge all over the place. And that is really reflected in the songs.
Yeah. I love that you do that. So Pussycat was another one of my favorite albums of yours. And the fact that you're so unafraid to just say exactly what you think about very specific people and things that are going on, it makes sense that, of course, the albums afterwards would then like catch us up to where we are currently.
Well, I tried not to be too specific with this stuff, just because there's a danger when you name names that it's going to be jarring years later to hear those names when they're not in the news anymore. So I think the new stuff is not as specific, and it's more generally just angry and out for blood, really out for vengeance and sick and tired of it all, but in a not in a it's not a hopeless album. It's more just really driven to justice, I think. And it's trying to use, wanting to use, I don't know. It's actually not hopeful. That's for sure. It's not a hopeful album. It's resigned.
Yeah.
I think that the idea of wanting the bad guys to be punished is, I guess, any way you could say that's hopeful, because it's not accepting that the bad guys will win. It won't accept that the bad guys are winning.
Yeah. I think that it's hard to be hopeful all the time anyway at the moment. And I think it would be very jarring to just make albums full of really happy music. Although I understand escapism is important, and I'm not slamming anyone who makes happy music at all. It's just personally, I'm more about mirroring what's going on and then sort of trying to imagine different realities, I suppose. I suppose I just want to keep reminding people that they have personal power and they don't have to just let this stuff happen to them as well.
Yeah, and I think music itself is an escape. Whatever the content is, whatever the music is saying, I think it does. It's still an escape. Whatever, no matter what is being said. For me, anyway, the act of playing music is an escape for me. Even if I'm singing my songs about wanting to punish someone, it's like I go into this other space in my brain and my emotion where I'm ecstatic in a way, because it takes me out of my physical reality, and I feel like I'm in another better place where I'm above it all.
Yeah.
Not in a prideful way. I just mean above it, like I'm floating above it.
Yeah. I was thinking about it's kind of stretching time, because we stretch experiences out into songs. So like a thing that took a second or a feeling that lasted for a few minutes can you know, fill a whole song, a whole album, whatever.
Yeah.
So it's that floating above thing's really interesting too. I like that.
Yeah. I like to write about the truth. For me, the truth is it's never really about smiling all the time. Some people think that it's good to try to smile all the time, but I would rather not smile when I don't feel good. I'd rather just be honest about it. For me, that just makes more sense for me.
Well, it's more realistic, isn't it? I think it's especially with things as they are online. It can just be like this barrage of shiny, shiny stuff and everyone having a great time and everyone knowing how to use all the computer software, you know.
Yeah.
And feeling like we're the ones who have a problem. but everyone's going through everything.
Yeah. And I think, I guess I'm just trying to be a voice for some other kind of truth or some other kind of reality. I'm not trying to do anything. I'm not trying to put any message out there. I'm just trying to express myself. That's mm-hmm. all. I think for me, that's just what I do. I'm trying to express the truth of my own existence.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because there are all these messages coming at us that are telling us to be a certain way, or, you know, telling us that we are supposed to understand all the technology and we're supposed to like it and we are supposed to buy it every few years. And, you know, I don't believe that's true. So I talk about that kind of stuff. Like, I don't like that. I don't like this. I don't like that. I don't accept it. I talk about that stuff and all the other things that the culture tells you, and the culture and media, they tell you that you're supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to be able to do everything well. You're supposed to be happy. You're supposed to be married or partnered. You're supposed to have kids, you're supposed to own a home. You're supposed to buy this stuff, all that stuff. I reject all that stuff. And I talk about it.
Yeah. And the thing is, we're humans. So if we have an emotion, we feel something about something. We're not the only person who's ever felt that way, because we're not robots or we're not an alien. So we're not as alone as we feel.
Yeah.
There's this thing I was learning about the other day. I wish I could quote it. I'm terrible at that stuff. But someone was talking about a study where people were told a story about someone who was like an outsider, and then someone who wasn't an outsider, and almost every single person identified with the person who was an outsider, because everyone feels this way. They might not seem like they do, and maybe not everyone, but many more people than we might think feel like they're the outside person. And so if you're making outsider art, or making art that is from the place of feeling that way, then I think people will respond to that because they feel that way too. You know?
Yeah. And I think that's what I'm totally invested in that, or I rely on that, hoping or knowing and understanding that other people feel like I do, and that and that people are not just types. They're not, you know, you can't just put everyone into a category, which is what the media tries to do, and even what people try to do. I think that people are so brainwashed right now by all the media, and that they really think of people as representations of types, and that if you go out, if you say anything outside the boundaries of what your type is supposed to say and think and feel, then people are like, that's not normal, or that's different, which that's just a strange modern way of looking at things. You'll hear some, if you have a point of view that doesn't fit into one of the representational categories, someone might react and say, that's different. Like, your take on something is different, which is like, you can't even, different is not a descriptor. It has to be different to something else. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes. Very good point. Yeah. Do you find the internet to be a generally good thing in your life?
Oh, I have such mixed emotions about this, because on any given day, there will be a moment in the day where I'm saying, I hate the internet. The internet's bad. The internet's so bad. But then I'll find myself using the internet to I use it to keep my career afloat, basically.
Yeah.
Without it, I'm kind of screwed at this point, because these days I've been doing a live stream once a month, and I can just like broadcast a show to people all over the world, and then they can donate money if they feel like it. And I just can, it's like this direct me to them, them to me. And that's a wonderful, beautiful thing that I can do. And I can tell, you know, there's all sorts of wonderful things that I can do with the internet.
Yeah.
But then I also hate it.
Yeah. I feel the same. It's so great. Because really, it's not a thing that's separate from humanity at this point. It's just, it is the world, as well as the world is the world. It's all part of it. But it's, I mean, my whole new record's about my struggle with it. It's just like, it's awful, but then it's amazing. Because, you know, people will hear it via the internet.
Right.
So I'm screwed, yeah.
They won't know about it otherwise. And yeah. I feel so, I don't know how old you are and I'm not going to ask, but I feel so fortunate to have grown up before the internet.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in the 1970s. There was no internet. Well, at least it was probably being developed, but no one knew what it was. It didn't exist. There were no cell phones. Mm. It was just landlines, and cable TV was just like coming into homes in my neighborhood in the 80s. So, and when I was a kid, there were just a few television channels, no internet. And I feel so blessed to have had a life, to have known a life before the internet, because it's like now and then. It's such a completely different world now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't imagine I can't imagine growing up in this world today.
Oh, it's terrifying. I grew up in the 90s. Yeah. So I also remember a time before phones, internet, all that. And someone was asking me, oh, who was it? Maybe it was just Tim and I. I don't talk to anyone else. So it must have been him. Or maybe it's my sister. We're just talking about what did we used to do beforehand. We did a lot of crafting.
Uh-huh.
I did very complicated cable knitting as a child. And I did cross stitch. And I read loads of books. And I wrote in my diary. And I wrote letters to my friends. Actual letters that I posted in the post on paper. And it was brilliant. When I got home from school, the bullies could not have a go at me via several different social media channels.
Right.
I had a break from them.
Oh, yeah. And if you needed information, you had to go find the information. If you wanted to know the temperature outside, and in my town, we'd call a number. It was like 6 and 7, 1, 2, 3, 4. And it would say the time and the temperature. You could get that on the phone.
Yeah.
Or you had to look things up in the encyclopedia, or you had to go to the library.
Yeah.
If you needed information, if you had to do research, you'd go to the library and you'd like find the books that you needed, or you'd look at the old, you get on the, what do you call that machine?
Microfiche thing.
Yeah. Microfilm. Yes. You fight microfilm. You'd sit in front of a microfilm machine. You'd scroll like old newspapers.
Yes. I remember looking at those in our history class. We had to go into this dusty old place and look at those things. It was really good.
I'm not saying that was better. I'm just saying,
bring back microfilm, says Julianne. Yeah.
No, I'm just saying it was different. And you had to do more work to get information. I think that maybe you felt more secure that the information was true, because these days there's a payoff if you're putting out alternative information or fake news. Maybe a payoff for you, but back then there was no payoff.
Yeah.
News was just news. And now it's entertainment, and it's, oh my gosh. I sound like an old, like crotchety.
No more than I do. And the thing is though, like, I think there's so many wonderful things about it, and there's so many horrible things about it. And it is interesting to go, well,
exactly.
It used to be easier to focus on something. I do think that's true.
Yes. And I think that some people now look at, some people probably perceive intense focus as a, focus as something bad, or because if you're focused on anything for too long, then you're missing out on all the other things.
Oh, right. You know? Yeah. But you were talking about multitasking earlier, and I honestly think I used to pride myself on being able to multitask for some reason. I thought that, well, not for some reason, because the culture told me that was a good thing to be able to do. I was all over that, like, you know, 15 different tabs open, working on loads of different things at once. And honestly, I don't know if it's just from getting older or from thinking about this stuff more, but I just find it impossible. And I've been reading a lot of stuff about how it takes like 15 minutes to get your cognitive strength back once you've been interrupted in a task. Like it's like that.
Oh,
so if you check an email, then you're screwed for the next 20 minutes. You can't work at capacity in your brain after that.
I believe that. And that's the way, you know, everything is set up to work these days. It's set up to rewire our brains like that. And that's a scary thought.
Yeah.
And even I was just telling you that some days I work on recording or writing for only an hour or something. And when I was younger in my 20s, I would have these marathon songwriting sessions where I'd be up all night working on a song. And it was like, so thrilling in a way to just get so lost in the process and in the song I was working on. I could just go for like 10 hours and I'd go all night. And now that doesn't really happen anymore. And I don't know if it's because my brain has changed because of what's going on, the way that our brains are all being rewired by modernity, or if it's just because like it's an age thing, my brain is just like doesn't have the power anymore to focus. But it's definitely kind of sad and scary that I don't seem to have the capacity for the intense hours of focus that I used to. It makes me sad to think about it.
I've recently been experimenting a bit more though with like coming back to things continually, because I heard Amy Mann talking about songwriting and on a podcast once, and she was talking about how it's a good idea to keep the song present in your life if it isn't finished yet. So rather than start it one week and then leave it for a month, like just come back to it every few days or something.
Yeah.
Play through it and keep plugging away. And I was very guilty of like coming up with an idea, feeling quite satisfied with that idea, leaving it for ages, and then booking a studio and taking it in to finish it then and there, which was risky, I think, because the lyrics could maybe have been even better if I'd spent a bit more time beforehand. So I like now just like going back to things and doing, like you were saying, chipping away. I use that phrase a lot, just like doing a little bit more, a little bit more. And maybe it's to do with repetition, because you've done about 1,000 albums. So it's not like the first album you've ever done. So I'm going to stay up all night because it's like exciting and thrilling. And not that it's not exciting and thrilling, but it's just something else.
Maybe, yeah. I like to think maybe it's just because I have more of a grasp on how to do it now. Like that machinery inside of me that writes songs is more supple now. Or something, like I can get in the groove easier now, maybe. I don't know. It's a kind of a mystery.
Yeah, maybe it just doesn't take you as long to write the
songs. Yeah, that's what I mean. Maybe, I've just gotten a handle on it. I don't know.
It's got really good at it.
I don't know. I would never say that.
I know. I got the impression you wouldn't. So I thought I'd say it for you.
Okay.
I know you've got lots of chats to do today. So I'm going to wind up because I'd love to talk to you forever, but you have, you know, other things, other people to talk to. So just towards the end, I'd love to ask you what the word creativity means to you and how intentional you are about that.
Creativity is a way of living. It's crucial. It's what keeps me connected to life, really. It's really the only thing I can depend on. It sustains me. It's a life force, and I feel it's why I am here. And it's a lot of things that no one sees or hears that I'm working on. It's not just music. I do other things, and for myself.
Yeah.
I think it's sanity. I feel sad for people who are not accessing their own creativity and who are ignoring it, or people who say, "Oh, I can't draw." I think that's sad, because anyone who has a hand and fingers and a pen or a pencil can draw.
Yeah.
No one cannot draw. Anyone can draw. But if that attitude is so heartbreaking, because I can't draw means you think you can't draw something that looks like what you think it's supposed to be. You know, people say, "I can't draw," they mean they can't make a dog look like a dog. But why does a dog have to look like a dog? And that attitude, the attitude like, A dog does not have to look like a dog. That attitude is a really good attitude for life, I think.
Yeah.
Like you can draw a dog and it can be whatever it wants to be. It doesn't have to look like a dog. And that's kind of my philosophy of life, that individuality is good. It's fine. You don't have to fit into a category. You don't have to fit into a group. You can be an outsider, and that's okay, because whatever is true is okay.
I'm just grinning because that's such a beautiful way of putting it. If someone came to you and said, Juliana Hatfield, I want to be creative in my life, what should I do? What would you tell them to do?
I would say, take a piece of paper, a blank piece of paper, and a pen, or whatever you like to, whatever feels pleasing to your hand, you know, pen, pencil, magic marker, crayon, whatever. Take a piece of paper and that writing utensil, and then look at something in the room, whatever it is in front of you, a flower, a book, a dog, a table, whatever. And then without looking at the paper, only looking at the object, draw it without looking at the paper. Mm. And then when you're done, then you can look at the paper. And this is an exercise that I did not invent, that anyone who's been to art school probably have been told to try this technique. But it's great to draw without looking at what you're drawing, and it will maybe open your heart and mind to creativity. And the things that show up on the page can be so genius and so surprising and so funny and so beautiful and artistic. And it's just like I try to do it a lot, drawing without looking. And it always helps me feel better about everything.
I was trying to do a lot of drawing because I'm someone who was like, I can't draw. And then I realized that was dumb. And I started trying to just do it. And I did some online classes and stuff. And this I think it's called blind contour drawing, isn't it? If you want to put a name to it. And I remember I was doing a bunch of sketches. And then when I look back at the sketchbook, those ones were the ones I liked way more than the ones I was trying to make look like a cup or whatever. They just had something more to it.
Yeah, and they will show you a part of you that you never knew you had inside of you, or it'll show you something outside of yourself that you are able to access. It can be really eye-opening, and it kind of shows you how much that you don't know in a great way, how much you can access and without having had any idea that you had access to this kind of thing. And I've tried to get other people to do this with me, and some people are so resistant to it, and it's like they're really freaked out by it, and by not being able to look at the paper, they're just like totally freaked out by the loss of control. But letting go of that control is such a good exercise, and it leaves me more open to everything. It helps me to be less controlling in my thought. And it's just like a really good exercise to do.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It seems to link back to what you were saying earlier about that piece of music that you had on the tape that you didn't think was any good, or you'd given away, and then it came back and you forgot you'd written it, and then it became a song. Because I think it's really easy to like write a song, or not easy to write a song, but it's easy to finish something or start something even, and then look at it and immediately discard it because it's not good enough, or it's not what you thought it was going to be, or something. Whereas if you have that distance, so like I'm looking at these blind contour drawings going, oh wow, that's really cool from 2 summers ago or something, but probably I would have looked at it that day and gone, that's not a photorealistic representation of a cup, I suck at art, I'm never going to draw again,
right?
You know, and it's like letting go of that expectation that everything has to be how you thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Because that was just a thought. It wasn't anything yet.
Right. Just let go of the expectations or the, it's good when perception changes, when you can see things from different points of view, I think.
Yeah.
And maybe sometimes that takes a few years to be able for you to be able to see something in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. So don't delete your ideas library then, is what you're saying to me.
Unless you're being buried, literally buried by it, and you can't breathe.
Yeah.
And you have to dig your way out. Then you can maybe like think about getting rid of the stuff that does not spark joy.
Yes. I'll just Marie Kondo the shit out of my computer. That is sort of one of my plans, actually. One day. Well, look, it's been such a wonderful thing to talk to you today. I really appreciate you coming in and doing this.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I think you know what to do. If you haven't got your copy of Blood yet, please visit juliannahatfield.com for all the information you need to change that fact. The deluxe show notes page for this episode is at penfriend.rocks/Juliana. There's a really excellent short film about Juliana on that page, as well as links to her back catalogue. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a music-loving friend, and you're both very welcome to grab 2 free songs and receive thoughtful letters on music and art via my website. If this was your first episode of Attention Engineer and you'd like to continue this journey, I think you might enjoy episode 1 starring Tanya Donnelly and episode 22 starring Bernard Butler. Make sure you subscribe to the series too. My new album Exotic Monsters is out now, and I'm running seriously low on limited edition coloured vinyl, CDs and other fun bits of merch, so check out all things Penfriend at penfriend.rocks. This podcast is powered by my Correspondence Club. Huge thanks to you all. And if you feel inspired to sponsor a future episode and get a shout out, please head to penfriend.rocks/sponsorship. As I said earlier, this show is now a fortnightly one, so I'll catch you in a couple of weeks to share my conversation with Shingi Shoniwa. Till then, take care. I can feel a storm coming.